Hello and welcome to Big Head Mode for another week. I'm your host, Ben O'Brien. Tonight we are talking all about the game that I find personally destroys your soul from within until you're a husk, Bloodborne, and joining me in the studio to talk about that is Job Gilroy. Job.
How's it going? How's your soul?
It's not there. It's not there anymore. And look, I mean, we'll talk about this later in the show, but I'm going to need you to give me a pep talk, because I'm finding it really hard. And every time I've ever talked to you about Dark Souls, you always manage to talk about it in a way that I go home thinking, oh, yeah, I've got to give it another try. But, oh boy, it's hard going. You've been having a lot of fun with it, though, right?
Yeah, I have. I've been having a lot of fun. I think I might have hit a wall. I may have hit a wall. There might be problems in Bloodborne. But
really?
But from the start to the finish of the game, in that contained experience, still absolutely brilliant. And it is as brilliant as any Souls game ever was.
Oh, man. How's that for sizzle? So we'll get to that later. But first things first, what else have you been playing at the moment?
I don't know if you've played much of it or seen much of it, but Elite Dangerous is a game that came out last year. And
I've just heard that it's an incredibly authentic sort of spaceship dogfight game.
It's more than just dogfighting. It's, you know, there's trading and piracy, and you know, the piracy ship piracy.
Yeah, not Texas Dallas Buyers Club.
Yeah, exactly. Not the sort that you'll get you in trouble with IINet, but so piracy and all kinds of stuff, mining, space mining, because everyone really wants to be a part of. Nobody wants to do that. What it does amazingly well is it takes these massive scaled areas and it shrinks them down into a manageable concept. Like, not even a manageable area, because it can still wind up taking you 10 minutes to get from one place to another.
Mm.
But it's a manageable concept. You understand, you know, cognitively that you are, I am 100 light seconds away from this next place. It's going to be a bit of time before I get there.
Well, so on that, like, what is the scope like in that game in terms of actual environments?
One to one, apparently.
Oh my god! And so it's an exploratory kind of game.
It is, yeah. Exploring is a huge part of it. And so you sort of start off in a star system, and it's your job to sort of go find some, you know, aim to misbehave. You got to find some trouble somewhere.
Yeah.
And it might be in another system. And so when you jump to another system, you go into hyper drive. And
of course, as all good space travels, right? Game needs.
And so that leaps through light years in no time. You know, it takes a couple of seconds. But then once you hit the massive orbit of a sun, then you get dropped into super cruise, it's called. And suddenly you're traveling at 3 to 4 times the speed of light very quickly, but you're no longer traveling, you know, light years in seconds. And so that's a completely different concept altogether, and you've got to manage your speed, and then you sort of come in at a planet or one of the, you know, planets in the solar system, and then you've got to slow down to just hundreds of kilometers an hour, and then slow down further to just, you know, a couple of hundred kilometers an hour.
I can't even comprehend this game.
It takes some real doing. And then
is this multiplayer as well as...
It's massively multiplayer in inverted commas, because everything sort of exists in an instance. So it's instance multiplayer, where you'll leap to another star system and you can still chat to your friends in the different systems, but they won't be in your game per se until they reach that instance that you're in. Meanwhile, you know, you've got random people in that instance, and they can, you know, shoot you if they want and try to steal your stuff, or
if they want. It's the internet. They will.
People most of will the time, they to. Will. Yeah, yeah. I found that I lost my good ship, and I'm back to a quite a bad ship, and I found I'm just cannon fodder. People just, oh, he's in an eagle. Get him. He is easy killings.
So is that sort of how you can tell the novice? You judge people by the... Is that sort of like
the
your
ship
level rank?
Yeah, well, you could upgrade
could be,
your
could
ship.
It could be a great way to just to play a prank on someone. You know, you just lie in waiting, and then little do they know you've got a thermonuclear device strapped to the bottom.
You can get away with something quite similar. Like, you can upgrade your eagle to have, you know, more guns than it should and better engines than it should and better shields. And then suddenly, you know, a Cobra might come in and think, yep, here's easy pickings. And then suddenly, pew, 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 pew. And yeah, they're dead. They're dead meat. And that is, that's the essence of what Elite is about to me, you know, like being that sort of rogue spaceship captain and getting away with stuff like that. But
yeah,
I think one of my friends summed it up very well. He said, at the moment, like when you're in an Eagle, when you're in an Eagle or the smaller ship, I can't remember what it's called, it's terrible, and I've just sort of erased it from my mind. But when you're in those smaller ships, it's the equivalent of being in an X-Wing in an assault.
Oh man.
And it's awesome when you're in a dogfight with other X-Wings or, you know, with TIE Fighters. But as soon as, you know, any sort of larger ship sees you and decides to pay attention to you, you're dead. Like, you've got no chance. See, you're just done.
What you're describing is just one of the many things that I feel was missing from what we were promised with Destiny. Like,
right?
I remember when they first pitched that game, they talked all about how you fly in real time from planet to planet and all that stuff.
Yep.
And, like, that's just, that would have been awesome.
Yep.
And they'd already sort of, they'd sort of tinkered with you know, spaceship controls in Halo Reach.
Yeah,
that's true. You know, they totally could have chucked in a, you know, a Star Fox style.
They should have. They absolutely should have. Although,
it would have been great.
I mean, doing it in Elite, that's, it's not as easy as it
no,
could possibly
seem. No, this
sounds
a lot more heavy duty. And
I use my Xbox 360 controller. I don't have a joystick. The joystick is the ideal way to play it. But I use an Xbox 360 controller, a keyboard for certain menu options.
And then an eject button, just for when things get a little hot.
I don't think you want to eject in space. I don't know how that one works
out. That's a good point, actually.
No, I've got this program called Voice Attack. And so if I say certain things, if I say frame shift or jump, then I'll jump into hyperspace.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and it does like all sorts of things like that. And I can manage increments of speed using that, you know, 25 plus
See,
or
you know
50
what? Like,
plus.
I've been watching a lot of Battlestar Galactica recently.
Yeah.
And I really want a game that's like that, but specifically for like a huge Battlestar simulator. Like, where you're in the control room, and it's just command, and it's all about just, like, managing, you know, how many troops you're deploying, where you're sending them, but have it all be real, like, from inside the control room.
I think there's a Star Trek-themed one, where one person is the captain, and you have to recruit other real people to play the roles.
Like human players?
Human players
see,
to
cool.
play the different roles on your bridge. I can't remember what it's called, but, yeah, it definitely exists, and apparently it's nuts, like really difficult to play, and yeah, a lot of fun, but
yeah,
I suppose you'd have to be invested. I suppose if you had that much equipment, you'd probably be invested.
Yeah, probably. Star Trek fans get invested in their fiction that easily?
By the dictionary definition of the word, if you had that much equipment, you'd be invested, I think. Yeah.
I've been playing a lot of, you know, and I said it last week on the show that I was trying to put it off, and I'm pretty sure it was like maybe half an hour after that show I went home and just gave in and played the latest episodes of Game of Thrones and Tales from the Borderlands, the Telltale versions, and they're phenomenal games.
How is Tales, like, I haven't played Tales from the Borderlands.
I'm assuming you played a lot of the other Borderlands.
Yep.
It's just given me a whole new perspective on it. Like,
yeah.
Not only do I think it's probably the best Telltale game yet, just in terms of pacing, like, because
right.
it's not because it is fun and sort of narrative and sort of like, I guess, comedy driven,
yeah,
it doesn't have all those down periods that you get in Walking Dead and Game of Thrones where it's all moody and everyone's sort of contemplative about, oh, this horrible thing that's just happened. It's just like, it's just constantly moving forwards,
yeah,
and it just means that, like, you never feel like you're not doing something really exciting, and because you have these two different characters. And it plays with that sort of unreliable narrator thing. You know, you've got the two characters narrating what's happened to this guy who's holding them hostage.
Yep.
And each of them lie.
Yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't take itself seriously, and it's just a lot of fun. But, like, this episode two.
Yeah.
And I can't believe it's only two episodes because it feels so full. Episode two, I feel like, injects so much intrigue and just new things to the world of Borderlands that it made me go back and start playing more Borderlands. Like, you know, in my head, oh, this world is so much deeper than I ever thought it was. I mean, it's the same game it always was, but yeah. Just like they really make like they make a lot of really interesting things based on the stuff that we already know from Borderlands.
Where does it sort of sit in the canon?
It's right after Borderlands 2.
Right. Okay. Cool.
And it's great because it references events enough that you pick up on little things here and there and characters show up, but it's just totally standalone as well.
Yeah.
These two characters that you play are really unique. Like, they reference sort of things that you know. Like, one of them is a member of Hyperion, so you're sort of used to that really rigid stereotype or you know, like, joke of a corporate sort of lackey.
Yep.
And then the other person is just a Pandoran con artist. And
right.
It's really funny. It just makes me wish that the original Borderlands games were more like that.
I think, look, I have played literally hundreds of hours of the Borderlands games. Like, I did two marathons for them for charity. I think they both definitely have a lot of humor in them. It's just the delivery mechanism that it uses, which is that typical MMO-style quest-giver narrative. It just doesn't... Like, when it's on, it's very on, but most of the time, you're skipping it. You're like, I don't care. I don't care what you're saying.
Especially in multiplayer. Like, even if you want to listen to it,
you'll
just sort of halfway through a conversation with a friend notice that someone's been talking and miss entire chunks of
or
dialogue.
Or your friend will be, you know, jumping around, hitting you in the face attempting to start a duel.
Yeah.
While you're like, oh, and then they said that. Interesting. Yeah, no, jewels on, we're dueling. Shut up, Joe, duel us.
Whereas,
yeah.
like, Tales from the Borderlands just has really slick, because they're in control of all the presentation.
Yep.
It's like, you know how great it is in Borderlands when you introduce a new character and you get one of those really cool?
Yep.
It's just like that the whole way through.
Yeah, cool.
It's just like when they're actually entirely in charge of, and I know this is Telltale, not Gearbox, but I mean, Telltale have taken what they know works from the Borderlands games and just gone, all right, well, people like this, so let's just make a game entirely out of this.
Yeah,
and it's just tremendous. It's awesome.
Did you ever play Tiny Tina's?
I did
DLC,
and that's probably I think the best it is, that it's ever been, including pre-sequel.
Yeah, definitely. I thought pre-sequel didn't compete with most of the DLC for Borderlands 2. I thought it was a good enough game.
There were a couple of things that I thought were improved in terms of narrative. Like, your characters talked more and there was more
Definitely.
They did more to bring you into it.
I thought General Knox was the only DLC that specifically... General Knox from the first game. The Armory. In terms of comedy, was the only one that I could think could compete with Tiny Tina's Dungeons & Dragons game DLC. Like...
Now, was that the one where they introduced Moxie for the first time?
No, I think she had her own DLC.
Oh, no, that's right. She had the Gladiator Arena.
Yeah. No, this one introduced the character of General Knox, and he was just this so completely tired of everyone's bullshit on Pandora. Don't care. Please just let me go home and do whatever. Like, just, okay, you stole this. I don't care. Yeah, hilarious.
It's great when they subvert that sort of stuff. Like, I remember there was a great line from Torg in pre-sequel where he makes a reference to being friend-zoned, and then he cuts back in and he says, because it was a flashback, he cuts back in and he's like, I've since learned that obviously that's a really unhealthy attitude to take towards platonic friendship with a woman.
Yep.
It was always really great. Yeah, I do hope that Tales from the Borderlands sort of gives them an idea of where to steer things for Borderlands 3.
Yeah, yeah. Especially now that the lead writer has departed.
Yeah.
I can't think of his name right now.
Anthony Birch,
yes.
Yeah. He was a huge part of the last two games too, so it'll be interesting to see where it actually... I hope it doesn't just go down the wacky, you know, keep things wacky route. Like, it would be nice if they did make it more of a fleshed out world.
I would like them to take a look at what Wasteland 2 did. I don't know if you played much of it, but it wasn't like definitely not funny. Not funny most of the time, but it did have like bits of humor in it. But when it was treating the concept of post-apocalyptic wasteland Yeah, it did it really well.
And when you invested, like, more heavily invested in a world, you don't have to try as hard with the humor either. Like,
exactly.
When you're when you're right there with the characters, one little joke is great. That's all you need.
Yeah.
Let's go to a song. This is the theme you might recognize, the Skyrim main theme by Jeremy Soule. And we're going to come back and we're going to talk about some gaming news. You're on 2RRR 88.5 FM. Welcome back. We're all feeling appropriately epic now.
Fushroda.
Now, we were talking in the break before about Rockstar and you know, GTA. Now, have you read about Daniel Radcliffe in talks to be playing one of the houses?
Sam Houser, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I did see this. That'd be really interesting. See, so as I understand it, BBC are going to do a mini series about the rise of Rockstar.
Which is a great idea.
Fantastic.
Like,
idea.
If we can start getting more, just the fact that anyone's even considering doing a creative work on the people behind the games industry, and it's not like, you know, Gamer with Jared Butler.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or, you know, that that indie games movie that made everyone look like a self-absorbed weirdo.
Game Loading?
No, not the recent one.
I haven't seen that
one. That one's really sweet. No, the Indie Games, the movie order.
Oh, called. With the one that was the Phil Fish story.
Yes. Horrifying. Everyone looks super self-absorbed. It was terrible. Well, not everyone. That's not fair. Edmund McMillan came off of that, but
it didn't do justice to the craft.
No, not at all. Yeah, So yeah, I'd love to see, especially, you know, a dramatized version, because the real life version, as I already understand it, the bits I understand, is pretty dramatic. I mean, yeah, they started out as, I think, a semi music label, and got into games, but I assume.
And it looks like the angle of it is that it's going to cover a lot of that that sort of war between Rockstar and Jack Thompson.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like this is what, like, they've released of the actual. I mean, it looks like it's going to cover a large part of their career anyway.
Yep.
But it looks like the significant chunk of the drama in the middle is going to be the back and forth,
the hot coffee,
controversy. Which, I mean, when you look back on it now, it's a very odd controversy, isn't it? I mean, I can't imagine anyone caring that much in a game if that came out today. I mean, you've got stuff more extreme than that that's in games deliberately.
Yeah, well, there was a hot coffee for Grand Theft Auto 4, wasn't there, I believe.
Was there?
Yeah. Yes, because they modelled in actions, and so people got away with modding it in. But nobody really cared. It didn't really have the same impact.
I mean, now people will make, you know, nude mods for Skyrim and just weird, depraved stuff.
I think nude mods for Skyrim is actually very tasteful compared to some of the mods I've seen for Skyrim, which are horrifying.
If you're talking about the Thomas the Tank Engine replacing dragons, you're right. That's the stuff of nightmares.
it is funny. Like, that will be a very interesting avenue for them to take with that story, because I guess Rockstar would be far more involved with them doing that. You know, that's a definite victory for them, as opposed to telling about, you know, them coming up from, you know, the music business and all the Coke parties.
Are you worried at all that it might gloss over some of the more?
It's absolutely going to gloss over.
Yeah.
Stuff.
I mean, you hear a lot of things about Rockstar, and obviously, you know, especially with the big AAA game companies.
Yep.
You just have, like, sort of incredibly rigid, you know, business models and intense workloads. And it'd be really interesting to actually have an exploration into the, you know, the people who give the orders, the people at the top of the pyramid.
I think, like, you know, like, I remember, you know, L.A. Noire was developed in Sydney at Team Bondi, who weren't actually based out of Bondi. They were based out of Ultimo. It was literally a 5-minute walk from where I lived. And the way they were treated, the hours they worked were horrifying, like truly horrifying. And that's not on Rockstar's plate, you know. That's all games development has this culture of crunch that is despicable in a lot of ways. You know, there's no union available to game developers.
No.
So there's no way they can ever get out of it.
And the age of DLC and everything, it's sort of like, when does it end? You know, you're working for months after a game's actually come out, just to make sure that, you know, the online's running smoothly, and then they help release all the DLC packs. And then it's like, okay, let's get underway for big game 3.
I have actually heard nothing but positive things about DLC, and the reason for that is that traditionally, once the game was shipped, the smaller studios would just fire 90% of their staff and hire them back on when they had the next project, whereas DLC allows them to keep those developers on making DLC, or as many as they can on making DLC, while they get started on the next project. And so it's actually a little bit better for developers that DLC keeps the cycle going. On the other hand, if it kept you doing 90-hour work weeks, I don't know how enthusiastic you'd be about continuing. I don't know if I'd be enthusiastic about continuing.
Now... something else that's been really bothering me. Are you a big fan at all of Conker's Bad Fur Day?
No, I was a PlayStation guy.
Dear me.
I know, yeah. It was war in my high school.
Well, to an extent, then, you'll probably still be just as underwhelmed by this whole Conker in Project Spark thing as I am.
I did see this, yeah.
So, I mean... They've now revealed how much it costs and how much gameplay there actually is. And so it's $5 and you get 1 hour.
Yeah.
And they've said that they're not making... there's no plans to make any Conker game, remake, any new game. It's just... they're just toying with the nostalgia of fans at this point. Like, I'm not going to pay, $5 to play a pale imitation of a game that I loved for an hour when I could just go play the original game and love it to the same extent.
How many people would pay $5 for a pale imitation, though? I guess that's the grand
hopefully
experiment.
Hopefully a lot less than...
nobody, but...
also, I mean, how many people even have Project Spark to begin with?
Well, yeah, that's true, yeah.
Have you ever played any of that game at all?
I think I played it at Gamescom, 2 years ago.
Yeah, I downloaded the beta and played it, and it just sort of... I don't know.
It's a intriguing concept. It's a fun way to give people the ability to create their own worlds, their own games. But I didn't feel like I had any real power over the creation process, you know. But, you know, I admittedly only played it for a very short amount of time. So
when it comes to those sort of games where, you know, you have the two modes, the playing the game and then the building the game, are you a player or a builder?
I think if we were to think about Minecraft, I would absolutely be a player. Definitely spending a lot more time destroying than I am creating.
I think that's where a lot of these games, the problem with them, you know, a game like Minecraft gives you the tools to comfortably do both, you know, you can get, if you're playing with friends, you can get into a really good rhythm of I'll be the guy who cuts down the trees, kills monsters, and just goes underground for days on end.
Yep.
And you guys can build all the nice looking stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas a game like Project Spark, it felt like there was just nothing for me.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think that's why games Minecraft is one and Trials is another. These games that have a game section and also have a creation section. Then, you know, when you're playing Trials, you get to play the wacky stuff that people have created. Little Big Planet 1 and 2 were another great example. I don't think Little Big Planet 3 is a good example of anything except for how not to, treat a successful franchise. But, yeah, look, you've got to have that game and the creation. Otherwise, the players will just get bored before they ever get
to bad for developers, because it was different developers, wasn't it? I feel really bad because we've seen it happen with, to an extent, with the Borderlands pre-sequel and the Arkham Origins game, where you have these other developers take over an established franchise, and they're clearly given no freedom at all to mess with the formula. And so it's like, okay, well, here are the things you can do. You can add a couple of new playable characters, come up with a cool new setting. It's just they must be so frustrated being in that thinking, but at the same time, they'd have all that pressure of we've got this franchise riding on us. We can't be the ones to screw this up. Gears of War Judgment was another one too.
Call of Duty is a really good example of how, you know, Treyarch, when they weren't allowed to do anything interesting, produced literally the worst Call of Duty of all time, Call of Duty 3, the big red one, which might be one of the worst games of all time. It's definitely in the bottom 100. And then when they were given room to move, they went on to create, you know, Black Ops, the Black Ops games. And I actually, the last Call of Duty I really, really enjoyed was Black Ops 2.
Yeah.
So
I'm with you. They're the only ones that I think I enjoy at all, really, these days.
Well, Treyarch do so much more than just making a run-of-the-mill run-and-gun shooter. They make, you know, there's all this hidden stuff. You can play Zorg and stuff like that.
And they understand, like, I feel like their multiplayer is catered towards fun and not just this sort of giant machine that just churns out conveyor belt levels and guns.
Prestige and
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's the closest I felt like getting back to that classic arcade sort of multiplayer shooting that I grew up on with.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And so, obviously the announcement that came out today or last night of
Sweet segue.
Black Ops 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm guessing you're excited about that too, then.
I was actually hoping, I knew Treyarch were working on this one, because, you know, rule of threes, but... Yeah.
It's like that, an Assassin's Creed game's going to come out.
Yep.
You know, there's just these things you always know are going to happen, and...
Yeah, yeah. I was actually hoping they were doing a World at War 2, though. That was my personal prayer, because I'd love to return to World War 2. I know it's played out as of a decade ago. You know, everyone got over World War 2 games.
It would
but,
be good to see what Treyarch could do with that, though.
Exactly. I think they'd do some really interesting stuff, and I think it'd be great to see what technology would afford us in a World War II game these days. Mm. You know, Red Orchestra 2, I don't know if you've played it, but it's, you know, ultra hardcore, but it's almost exclusively for loonies. You have to be very attached to the concept of playing a World War II shooter. Whereas with the Call of Duty game, you know, people will jump in, they'll get an MP40, everyone recognizes the Thompson machine gun.
Mm.
People are excited, you know. World War II could easily be back in if Treyarch were to make it so.
Look, let's get another song and then come back, and I think we should start talking about Bloodborne.
Sweet.
This is Ikari Warriors by the Mini Bosses. You're on Twitch 88.5 FM.
Here we go!
Welcome back. This is Big Head Mode, and we're about to get into some Bloodborne chat.
Yes.
Now, before we get too deep into it, I want to preface this joke by telling you my experience with Bloodborne so far, okay? I've been a very tentative Dark Souls player.
Yep.
And I don't handle with the crushing defeats very well. I tend to, when I get my ass kicked and I lose a lot of progress, I get frustrated, I put the controller down, and it's probably a few days before I go back to it. So I was tiptoeing through Bloodborne from the beginning, because I was just like, I was dreading playing it.
Because, yeah.
But I also really wanted to see what it was like. And I've played an hour and a half, 2 hours of it.
Yep.
And I've only died once.
Wow.
And I'm terrified. I don't want to keep playing now because I feel like I'm tempting fate. Like, it feels like it's been really... Those 2 hours have been just obscenely easy for me.
Yeah. So you've gotten to the first lantern?
Yes. And only easy... When I say obscenely easy, just easy because I've been expecting to just get slaughtered.
What class did you go and what weapon did you pick?
I have the mid-range weapon,
the axe.
The axe. Yeah. I can't even remember what the classes are called, but it's the one that's the closest to the hunter class from Dark Souls.
Oh.
It's sort of
So what, skill or strength, or what's the main stat on it?
Skill.
Okay.
And I think the thing is that because I always played the hunter, because it's a lot faster, Bloodborne, than Dark Souls.
Yes.
And I never played... I mean, I sucked at Dark Souls. But everyone's... I mean, I think it's because I played the Hunter or the sort of Swift dodge out of the way classes.
Yep.
And just... I investigated nothing at all in Dark Souls into what are the best classes, what are the best strategies.
Yeah, yeah.
I just kind of played it.
That's the best way to do it.
And, well, see, I found that, from what everyone told me, is that that was the worst class to play, or the hardest class to play, because it's all just about the reflexes of dodging rather than being able to block or you know, no ranged attacks, because I was, you know, using a sword.
Yeah, that was sort of the case, but you've become, by learning how to dodge a lot...
Yeah.
You've become quite well equipped to play Bloodborne.
That's what I think it is. I think I'm somehow, but I'm still waiting for the. I don't want to go back to it because I don't want to mess with this. Because when you're doing well in a you know one of these games, it's there's nothing like it. It feels so good.
Yep.
And I'm at that height at the moment, and I know I'm on the edge of this knife, and I'm gonna fall.
So have you reached the first boss?
I'm just before. The first boss.
So there's you're on this bridge.
Yes, yes.
And there's these two werewolves who are unbelievably difficult to beat at the level that you're at. Did you open up the shortcut to the boss?
No, I don't think so. At the moment, I'm just going back and grinding and trying to like.
But you know where the boss is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So don't bother grinding. Go back to where the boss is and explore the area without going into the boss fog. And you will eventually find a shortcut that allows you a quick path back to the boss. And that's what Bloodborne does that is better than anything else. All of the game, almost, 95% of the game is linked. So you can run from one end to the other. And in some cases, you can run from one end and find yourself halfway and then accidentally turn a corner and find yourself back at the start. Like... crazy shortcuts, brilliant shortcuts.
It's an amazing like world design.
It is.
It feels so much more robust is the right word. Just the depth to it and the design of it feels so much more intentional and deliberate than the Souls games ever did for me. Or I feel like I'm more aware of what the layout of this world is.
If your major experience was Dark Souls 2, then that is definitely the case, because Dark Souls 2 didn't have the intricate shortcut system. It relied more on teleporting between bonfires, while Dark Souls 1, it didn't paint the same picture that Bloodborne does. I think Bloodborne very easily finds itself painting a landscape picture that shows you your connection from one place to another, while Dark Souls... relied more on people not knowing where they were going, and so it was very easy for you to find yourself in an area you shouldn't be at while still, you know, doing your best to strive forward. That doesn't happen so much in Bloodborne. It manages to be quite linear while still allowing you so much freedom of movement. Which is, insane. Beautiful.
It is interesting how that freedom works, too, because, I find sometimes in games when you come to a crossroads and there's, like, six paths, it can just be so limiting because you just sort of... you don't feel the sense of freedom that it really is. But in Bloodborne, it's sort of like every path is just as... because you already accept that this game, that death awaits around every corner and that these games are just brutal... it's sort of like it liberates you from that decision. You just go, well, I'll just pick a direction.
It's definitely, you've definitely got to let go of the concept of death. Like it's going to happen, and you have to accept it, because it's going to come in bunches like you could not believe. Everyone I've talked to about this game, and all of them are very experienced Souls players, all of them have had trouble, like hair pulling trouble, with one boss, and it's never the same boss.
Really?
Ever. Never ever.
That's really interesting. Like, do you think that a large part of the difficulty in this game just comes from the change in pace to the combat? Just that everyone is really fixed in this one way of playing, and it's just like sort of...
I think you get away with beating bosses differently. So the boss I had a lot of trouble with is called Vicar Amelia. She swipes for days. She's got like just swipes and swipes, huge claws, and she kills very easily. She was very difficult. She took me, I think, 35 attempts before I finally beat her, and I was losing it trying to beat her. Like, I was so frustrated. I can do the run back to her in my sleep without getting hit by any of the mobs along the way. That was... like, other people got stuck on the boss I fought before her. I beat that boss in one attempt. Like, my first, I walked through the boss fog. There wasn't a boss fog. I just walked into the area, the boss arrived, and I beat it. And I walked away, and I'm like, yeah, it's, what? What do you got?
It's bizarre when, like, just this one game can have so many points of difference for so many different people.
I think it's a shift in mentality. I think you need to, like, I got away with doing it with, I think, the Bloodstarved Beast, which is the boss I one-shot. I got away with doing that because... that boss allows you to dodge backwards. If you dodge away instead of dodging forwards, you can get away with a lot more than you can with Vicar Amelia. If you dodge away from Vicar Amelia, you will get swiped a lot and you will die and you'll be very frustrated. You've got to shift your mentality into a dodging forward as opposed to dodging backwards attack or sort of strategy. And as a result, like, until you shift your mentality, you will die, and you'll die constantly. And it's a learning experience. And the learning experiences are what are the core of the Souls games experience. Mm. It's not just learning bosses or, like, learning boss mechanics. It's learning the game itself and learning the shortcuts and learning the world and learning what items do and stuff like that. You've accidentally picked probably the best starter weapon in the game. I know a lot of people never, ever shift from the axe.
But from what I'm, you know, am hearing about the game, it'll probably, you know, I've probably had an easier start than others based on the playstyle I'm used to, but it's only a matter of time before I get to that one that goes against the way I'm used to playing.
It's 100% coming.
Yeah.
And you've got to, like, you need to just abandon the concept of dying before you get to it.
I try to look at it now like it's Angry Birds or something. Not Angry Birds, Flappy Bird. You know? It's just a death.
Yep.
You know, all you do, you hit respawn. And I think in the Dark Souls games, I got really attached to the souls.
Yep.
I really like collecting. Because I'm a huge collector when it comes to games.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was just like, you know, if halfway through Banjo-Kazooie, someone came along and punched you in the face and took all your jiggies. Like,
yep.
it just went against everything I loved about games. And... Now it's killed the collector in me, these games. I treat any collectible as a bonus. If I get to keep anything, or actually take advantage of anything I pick up, that's a win. Like, I'm ahead of the game.
Like, you 100% have to know when to bank what you've got in Bloodborne, because the game will just continue. If you want to keep going, it will 100% allow you. And you'll find yourself in an area where you're not equipped to deal with it.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I think the most souls I've lost in Bloodborne, or sorry, Blood Echoes. The most Blood Echoes I've lost
in... Come on, this souls. Let's just call them out.
The most I've lost is 400,000. But if I'd lost like 40,000 2 hours earlier, I would have been 100% devastated. Like, just broken inside.
Yeah.
And that's... I think that's, yeah, what I love about Bloodborne is adjusting my mind to accept so many things, my own weaknesses, the game's weaknesses.
Yeah. How do you handle that sort of, I mean, you said before that you were getting really frustrated with that boss, and you're a pre-seasoned Souls player. I mean, do you still get as frustrated as you did when you first started?
You know, like, I... 35-ish attempts on one boss, it pales in comparison to my attempts in Dark Souls 1 and 2. I literally attempted the Duke's Dear Freya on NG Plus difficulty while still a very low-level mage character. I attempted that 300 times.
Oh my god.
Yeah, so I've gotten, like, I can't get overly frustrated anymore.
How do you handle it? I mean, do you sort of enter this sort of zen-like...
You do. You either enter that zen-like area, or I find if people are around, like if my wife comes home and I am up to like attempt number 290, and she'll come home and she'll be like, oh, how is your day? And blah, blah, blah. And we're like, yeah, it was good. And that's when things, you know, that's when I'm no longer 100% concentrating on the game, and I'm no longer in the zone. Even if the zone is seeing me lose constantly, I'm no longer in that zone, and I think the zone is what keeps me sane, because once you slip outside, you're able to think about how much time you've wasted and, you know, how much harder this has been than you expected, and, you know, how shit you are at the game, and it's just, oh.
There's a really funny sweet spot I find with the Souls games that you sort of get into where it's almost the opposite of physical exercise, where, you know, physical exercise, your first run, like, that'll be the most efficient you are, and then every new lap you do, you're going to gradually lose energy. Whereas I find with Souls, like, the first, I don't know, 10 lives are a write-off.
Yep.
Because you haven't readjusted to just exactly what you need to.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this really narrow margin, this sweet spot. And I find that, like, I feel myself getting closer and closer to beating bosses the more attempts. But then, like, then that the moment is gone, you know? If you push it and then you start to get tired and you start to get frustrated and then you start getting further from the moment again. And
yeah.
When that happens, all I can do is just walk away and
go,
all right, I'll come back to this later.
You've got to know when to, yeah, stop. And if you've still got all your souls when you decide to do that, thumbs up.
Yeah,
that's the best experience.
So, like, I mean, we've touched on a few of the changes. Are there any big changes that we haven't talked about that you really like or dislike to the formula?
You know, what's really interesting about Bloodborne versus the Souls games is that Dark Souls and Dark Souls 2 were games that were very much about the weapons. So you built everything about your character around the weapons. You chose your armor based on what weapon you're carrying. You put stats into different things based on the weapon.
Mm.
But that isn't really the case in Bloodborne. They've de-emphasized it, and they've changed it so that weapons are sort of secondary to player ability. Like, it's more important to be very good than it is to have a great weapon. And while having a great weapon is still very important, it's nowhere near as important as, like, in Dark Souls 2, if you had +5 clubs, you could stun lock bosses so that they would never even be able to attack.
Yeah.
That's never going to happen in
That'd in be Bloodborne. Too easy.
Too easy, yeah. No, but there is, you know, there's... The other thing they've done is they've added the gun parry system, and so many people aren't doing it properly, aren't using it properly.
Yeah.
It is the most important thing to master, because if you don't, you are going to get destroyed later on. It is 100% necessary.
Now, this is the system that gives you that small window of reaction time, but if you pull it off, you can turn basically any enemy attack into an attack on them, right?
So yeah, they get stunned and they fall to the ground and you walk up and you press the R1 button while you're basically touching them and you'll go into what's called a visceral attack and you will do massive, like 60-80% damage in one go. And there are definitely enemies in the game where if you're not doing this, you might not die, but you're using a lot more effort than you should be.
Yeah.
And so as a result, when we say every enemy, theoretically, there are theories about, you know, everyone's still sort of trying to work out everything about Bloodborne. There are theories everywhere that are saying that depending on your blood tinge stat, that's the stat that sort of manages your gun ability. Depending on that and depending on what weapon you're using, you may or may not be able to parry literally every boss in the game. I know Junglist, he talked about using the cannon, which is this massive cannon
that
uses 10 bullets at once. He used that to parry Vicar Amelia, when normally you can't do that to her.
Wow. And
it might have just been a damage threshold thing, but who knows? That's the beauty of Bloodborne at this stage, is that we still don't know everything. There's still so much more to learn.
Yeah.
And learning how to gun parry is paramount. It is 100%
necessary. How exciting is it? Because, I mean, I know that, the hardcore fans of this game, and I'm including you as one of them, it's like you all get so excited when one of these games comes out because it's new things to discover. Like, especially, like, I mean, Mark Serrells and Kotaku is a well-known huge fan of these series, and it's just like there's a new GIF or a new clip of something crazy that's been discovered. Like, there's a bunch of them every day, and there have been consistently since the game came out. It's sort of like, it's this great communal coming together of, like, let's all try and figure out this game.
Well, I think that's what the Souls games do really well, is that they allow people to decide whether they want to be explorers or they want to be tourists, and you get to choose what you're going to do. Like, if you want to be a explorer, you're, you know, reading up on theory crafting and you're, you know, testing out new items or new stat builds or stuff like that. But if you just want to be a tourist, you can jump into the game. There's a certain skill level that you need to be at, but you can jump on to Wikidot or Fextra Life and sort of read through the best stat builds that the explorers have already found for you, and you get to travel those paths that people have already gone down. So the explorers, they get on the path, you know, less traveled, and the tourists, they still get an awesome experience anyway. And I think that's the appeal of the From Software games, is that you get to choose which one you're going to do, and either way you're still going to have a brilliant experience, you know.
Now, like, we're running out of time there. Before we move on, I just want to ask you a question that I've noticed. I've seen people talking about recently when Bloodborne came out, because a lot of people, I think people who got the PS4 as well and haven't played the Souls games, were complaining a bit about the difficulty.
Yeah.
And, you know, that accessibility argument's come up again, because I think they feel, you know, this is an exclusive that I can't play in the way that I can others. I mean, how do you feel about that? Do you feel like these games could be more accessible, or do you feel like the moment they start sort of trying to compromise that, yeah, it's sort of, it's just taking away from,
like, pandering is the word I'd use, because that is exactly what they'd be doing if they were to accommodate
changing their vision to try and broaden the scope.
And I don't think they get away with it, because ultimately the Souls games, the From Software games, are about the player recognizing something within themselves. Like, you need that, or else the appeal it just isn't necessarily there. I mean, it's not to say that they're not deep RPGs, they're excessively deep RPGs, but to have everything handed to you on a platter would rob the game of, you know, its mystique and the sense of achievement and that entire explorer nature that I was talking about. And I don't accept that Bloodborne is too difficult. Absolutely, I had difficulty with one boss, but no, one boss.
I suppose it's like moving the goalposts closer to others, you know, when some people can already kick, you know. It's nice to have the goal. If you're finding it too difficult, it's like, well, the rules are there to learn and it's not going to change, you know.
Nothing in Bloodborne, I think, exists outside of the realms of the average human's ability. I think that's very important.
That just means I'm somewhere below average.
I think you just haven't reached your ability yet. Like, that's the thing. The people who say that it's too difficult simply haven't reached a stage yet where they are maximizing their own ability. Everyone can press R1. Everyone can press circle to dodge. Like, once you understand very simple concepts about the game, there's nothing stopping you. Once you understand how to gun parry, and once you understand that for, like, half the time that you're dodging, which is, you only step dodge when you're locked on to a boss or an enemy, right? So otherwise you'll just roll. So once, when you're step dodging, half of those frames, you are literally invincible. It doesn't matter if the sword goes through you from the boss, you are invincible. So as long as you can time jumping into a boss's sword, you have to jump into the sword yourself, but as long as you can time that correctly, there's nothing stopping you from getting in closer to a boss. There's nothing stopping you from killing anything.
Nothing stopping you, but just only a few thousand deaths.
Yeah, sort of, yeah, exactly.
Slowing your progress. But you can get there.
Yeah,
it
exactly.
is possible. Look, we're going to have some messages and then come back and say goodbye. Well, that's it for another week. Job, sure. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I think I'm going to have to give Bloodborne... I'm going to have to keep going.
You're
going
to have to
push it.
I insist.
I mean, maybe I need a trainer or something. Maybe I need to, like, treat it like a fitness regime. And
you were just saying in the break that you beat the pursuer on your first attempt in Dark Souls 2. There is genuinely no reason why you should feel that you are incapable of beating anything.
But that's the thing. As soon as I get a little bit of success, it goes to my head and I rush in and make a bad decision and then I lose all motivation, because I get my ass kicked well and truly.
You just need to...
I need to push through that barrier.
Know when to leave the table, you know? It's just...
Gotta know when to hold them and when to fold them. Look, You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, BigHeadMode2RRR, our website, bigheadmode.com.au. We've got a lot of videos and stuff coming out these days. We just put out Everybody Games video up there where Bob Carr talks about his love of Blood Dragon. That's worth checking out. And download the podcast as well. And while you're there, maybe give us a rating, give us a review, like and subscribe, all that stuff that you meant to say at the end of a YouTube video.
Yep.
Until then, we're going to play out with the Mass Effect 3, A Future for the Krogan by Jack Wall. We'll see you next week.
Bye.